All right, let's roll for initiative.
Roll for hosts.
All right, 1 to 20.
18.
20? Again?
Fuck you. Are you serious?
I'll roll it again just to make
sure.
No,
you, if you got 20, then
I hit 20 and that's 12. What I got.
Motherfucker. All right. Well done, Mike. Your host, second week in a row.
The second time I got an 11. I'm just saying, it's not always 20.
No, I'm down.
All right. Sorry, guys.
All right, but not really. The breaks.
If the show sucks again, it's Mike's fault again.
All right. Well, you heard them. I'm the host, and welcome to the Escort Mission Podcast. I'm here with Charles and Josh. Say hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
All right. Literalness over. All right. This is our second episode, and we're going to be doing some talking about a few issues today. Last time we just talked about Mass Effect 3, but we're going to change it up and try to do some variableness.
Hold on a second. You natural 20'd 2 weeks in a row. That is unbelievable. That is statistically unlikely. I would just like to point that out.
Phone hacks.
Noted. All right. So, well, let's just start off by, you know, having some casual conversation amongst ourselves that isn't forced or produced in any way, shape, or form. Oh, right. Yes. You out there with the bad aim and the terrible health and the crappy pathfinding, yes. Et cetera, et cetera. All right, Josh, what you been up to?
Well, Fez came out yesterday.
Woo!
But we can save that till the next section. Let's see. I beat Cut the Rope Experiments this week.
Say like, what?
Cut the Rope.
Cut the Rope.
Uh-huh. Experiments?
Like the sequel to Cut the Rope. You don't know about this game?
There's a sequel?
Yeah, how do you not know about this game? It's like the best phone game ever created, basically.
Oh my God, I haven't heard about this.
Did you guys play the first Cut the Rope, obviously?
Yeah, I played the first one. That's cool.
I wouldn't say it's the best phone game of all time.
Okay, what's better?
Drop 7 is objectively better than Cut the Rope.
Agreed, better.
Drop 7 is just an annoying puzzle game. Like, if you're into that, okay.
Yeah, which all I am. All right. I'm super into that.
But everyone should be into Cut the Rope.
Not an annoying puzzle game?
It's
just mechanically different. It's physics-based.
I think I spend more time in the Facebook app than Cut the Rope. I mean, come on.
Snap.
Harsh. Anyway, 100% of that shit, like, stars everywhere. Like, nothing but stars.
Nice.
I need some more levels.
Well, how do you feel about Angry Birds?
Cut the Rope is way better than Angry Birds. Uh-huh. Like, I understand why people like Angry Birds a lot. Uh-huh. It's pretty fun. It's well made, but it has this randomness to it that makes it like a slot machine. It makes it like a Plinko machine.
I don't think it is. I think you're just not accurate enough with your angle. Because if you get exactly the right angle every time, the results will be the same.
You can't get the exact same angle every time. No, you can't.
Yeah, you can.
No, you can't.
I can. You look on the background. You look where you are on the background.
I think Charles is saying you suck ass at that game.
Yeah, you're doing it wrong. You're doing Angry Birds wrong.
You're making them angrier, Josh.
I can get very, very close to the same angle every time.
There's, no matter how close to the same angle you get every time, there's enough random bouncing around that it's like a Plinko machine. Do you not agree?
No,
like
I don't agree.
You can make the same argument. Plinko machine, you hold the little circle in the exact same spot, drop it from the exact same height, and you know, but no matter how precise that is, it's gonna bounce.
A Plinko machine is truly random.
Right. Angry Birds is
not
simulating physics.
Angry Birds is a simulation
in a method like that has enough.
No way, because the bird that you throw, the little red bird, has exactly the same attributes every time, whereas the little steel ball in the Plinko machine, or the pachinko machine rather, is, you know, each one is minutely different. Each one is not perfectly spherical. Yeah.
No, I dare you. Like, we can prove this later. Uh-huh. All you need to do is pull that little bird back twice and make the exact same thing happen twice, and you're never going to do that.
I will absolutely do that. I do it every time I play the game.
Like, when you hit the bricks fall down to the every brick.
They fall
to the exact same spot.
Yeah.
When they fall, they're a little bit randomized. They fall a little bit to the left or right.
I mean, they're injecting that randomization then.
I don't think it's them injecting. I think it's more like the
what
Plinko
I'm saying
machine.
Is the
I
effect that you
they're
want
just simulating
to derive
the physics like more precisely.
I don't love Angry Birds. I want to make that clear to our podcast listeners. I really actually kind of dislike Angry Birds, and I think Cut the Rope is much better. But I don't think you're right that they have. I do feel like I can get the same result by putting the bird in the same place every time.
Well, we can settle this easily later because you're not going to get all those bricks in the same spot.
Okay, so getting like the third order.
Yeah,
the brick.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's exactly like a Plinko thing like three steps down.
Seriously? This is we're still talking about Angry Birds?
All right, move on. So Cut the Rope's good. Angry Birds space, like, those physics irritate me.
Space, I haven't even tried that.
Space does not have drag, folks. What? Space doesn't have drag.
What about Tiny Wings? I think that's a better game.
I thought it was all gravity.
It's not on Android.
I thought it was all gravity-based in Angry Birds space.
Is there... the gravity field thing is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. It doesn't... I mean, it's not precisely, like, real. It doesn't make sense. But it's internally consistent, mm-hmm, so that's mm-hmm. cool. But outside of those gravity bubbles, mm-hmm. there is no gravity.
Right.
So things like wood travel indefinitely.
Right.
Except there's drag, so they slow down and they stop.
Oh, that's stupid.
I know. Is that not
that,
like,
doesn't make any sense at all.
I was telling three other people that, and they said, why is that stupid? I said, what's wrong with you? there isn't like...
Apparently you don't know what space
thick,
is.
Thick, viscous fluid in space. Like, there's a tiny, tiny bit of plasma or whatever, but...
Let me guess, there's also sound effects in this space game.
I know. Yeah.
Because that's realistic.
But that's an old conceit. Whatever.
No, it's bullshit. That game is wrong. It should be banned.
Further wrong, yes. Duly noted.
The code should be put in a pile and burned.
So also, I just played a lot more of Mass Effect 3 multiplayer this week. We don't have to talk a lot about Mass Effect, but we didn't talk a lot about the multiplayer. I found a new, like, ridiculous build that just owns. It's the Infiltrator with the Carnifex that is the Solarian. That combination is so dominant, it's unbelievable.
And what is your skill layout?
So what you want to max all three of your skills.
But aren't there four skills?
There are five skills.
There's three skills and two passives.
Oh, okay.
So you want to max Energy Drain and Cloak, or whatever it's called.
Tactical Cloak.
And the whatever they call the grenade thing. Sticky.
Yeah.
Sticky mine or something?
Whatever they call
it. It's not the mine. The mine one is different.
Okay. Yeah, it's proximity mine. That's what it is.
Oh, it is proximity mine?
Yeah.
Okay. There is also a sticky grenade that's a different thing. Yeah.
So as soon as I learned, like, the sequence that just dominates, it's unbelievable. You tactical cloak, and then you immediately energy drain, and then you immediately start headshotting guys with Carnifex, which it's basically like sniping just multiple people really fast. You're taking everybody's shields out. You're regenerating your own shields often using energy drain. If you want to do AoE, you use the proximity mine in energy drain's place. Proximity mine does massive damage against armor. You're losing threat every time you cloak. Bonus damage. You never die. You're super survivable because you can get in out of any situation by cloaking and running away. You can resurrect your party members by cloaking. You can use those little terminals, hack terminals, really, really safely mm-hmm. by cloaking and running and using them. Man.
It sounds so like cloaking is a little OP.
It is. I thought it was underpowered. And those classes were annoying because you didn't have synergy between the cloak and your other abilities until you fully spec cloak, and then you get that one little option that says you can use one ability while cloaked. And once you have that, you can use one ability while cloaked, you can cloak and then shoot a proximity mine, or cloak and then energy drain somebody's shield and then start shooting and remain cloaked, and it's unbelievable. Yeah, it's super overpowered.
So is this is like the most satisfying build you found? You've been a resident build finder.
Yes, you have.
Well, I've gone through two other builds that I thought were phenomenal and overpowered. the Vanguard, where you equip virtually nothing, you stay at 200%, and you just repeat the biotic charge.
Nova.
And then Nova. And then biotic charge Nova, biotic charge Nova. And you don't have to do anything else. And you're pretty strong, but it's a little risky. And then the other one that I really liked was
the Sentinel.
Either the Sentinel or the Asari Adept by just doing warp throw. But the warp throw now, when I went back to it, the enemies dodge it like way too much.
They do dodge, especially on the higher metal difficulties.
The thing about that one though is you do have that homing capability, and
it does have homing and goes around.
Who cannot aim well enough to reliably score headshots, I definitely appreciate that.
That's why I still recommend that build for people's first build. All right, we can move on. That's basically this week.
All right, Charles? Nice.
Yes.
What about you?
So I have a bunch of stuff to chatter about. The first thing that I wanted to mention was the IPL, which is the IGN Pro League StarCraft II tournament, happened recently.
India Pale Lager.
Yeah. and there was sort of an interesting thing that happened there. I follow StarCraft II competitively. There's an 18-year-old Canadian transgendered StarCraft II player who's not on a pro team who made it really far in this tournament, and it was like a super sweet, really interesting story. Her handle is Scarlet, and typically the only people who ever perform well in these events are people who are on a pro team, who live in a house, who can basically practice the game 8 to 10 hours a day and, you know, build up that skill set. And this person beat players from like these top tier Korean pro teams.
Wow.
She beat players from Prime, FXO, Evil Geniuses, which is like a North American pro team, and made like a really serious run into kind of the later stages of this tournament. And it was just a super cool story, because what was so awesome about it, I think, was the contrast between how it was handled in the StarCraft II community and kind of the recent blow up that happened in the fighting game community, where there was a bunch of like sexual harassment at this Capcom event for Street Fighter Cross Tekken, and kind of the, I can only imagine what it would have been like had a transgendered, male to female transgendered player had performed well at like Evo or something like that. And maybe not. I mean, I know that there have been a lot of people who have said, oh, you know, that was one guy, and that's not what the whole fighting game community is like, you know. I don't know. It definitely seems like that's a much more aggressive, much more kind of male-dominated thing. And StarCraft II is very male-dominated, but sort of the general community reaction was like overwhelmingly positive. I thought that was cool to see.
That is cool. The StarCraft community is awesome.
Yeah, they're pretty dope. Mad Men. Do you watch Mad Men?
I do.
Do you watch Mad Men?
Yeah, but I'm behind this season. I'm waiting to marathon it.
Should I not spoil a part of
Mad Men? Yeah, don't spoil anything.
Okay, I definitely will not spoil. Okay. Anyway, the purse scene. Can I just say the purse scene? That was really amazing in the most recent episode of Mad Men. I thought that was excellent, excellent filmmaking.
It was very subtle, because it was one of those things where you're watching it and you realize that something is weird, but I'm not sure everybody necessarily picked up on exactly what happened, just that there was a moment where you're like, whoa, something significant is happening here. And if you get it, you're like, oh geez.
It was so brutal and just kind of devastating emotionally. And she's trying so hard and yet like still completely fails. And that is fascinating. This season is dealing with what is basically the core issue of the show, what you could tell the show's been leading up to from the first season, which is race and sort of the race relations moving out of the 50s through the 60s and on. So that's a great scene.
Yeah, it's really surprising they haven't gotten to that they've been able to hold off so long. In each of the previous seasons, they've found other controversial
topics. Yeah, and they kind of touch on it and glance off
it. To cover more in depth, but then they just barely touched on race so far.
Well,
I knew it was heading there.
The first episode, or the first time you ever see Don Draper in that show, it's like he's trying to relate to that black busboy, right? And realize like he can't do it, and he feels like an outsider, but he's not. And it has always seemed like that's where the show is heading. So I think that they're finally doing that. And the last thing I want to talk about was Esperanza Spalding. Have you heard of this person?
Nope.
I just caught her on The Daily Show. Apparently, she won Best New Artist at the Grammys. Quite recently, and like beat out a bunch of other like more popular people like Justin Bieber. She's totally super awesome. She's like a jazz vocalist. She plays bass. She has like a 12-piece orchestra.
That was this year's Grammys.
Yeah.
The same when Adele won.
Yeah, Adele won a billion things, I guess, but this person won Best New Artist, I guess, or something like that. I'm not sure about the Grammy winning stuff, but, if you like jazz, she's really, really awesome, and it's total Grammy bait. Like sometimes there's like Oscar bait type movies, like this is like a cripple making their way through the Holocaust or something like that. And it's like this is definitely designed to win an Oscar, and it feels like her band is that way, because it's just sort of this like it's a 12-piece like jazz fusion orchestra, like this multiracial panopticon of everything that's great about.
So it's America the band,
kind of, except not America
right,
the band.
The band,
which is
right, quote unquote America the band.
Yeah, it was. Anyway, she's really good. The music's awesome.
Now you said it's great if you like jazz.
What
if you don't like jazz? Like, will it bring you into the jazz world?
I think, it's probably a good entree into jazz. Because she's very soulful singer, very, You know, just an awesome horn section. You guys know my feeling on horn
You're
sections.
You're horny.
I am. I'm a horny guy. Horns make everything better. So Esperanza Spalding. Look it up.
Which is interesting that you mentioned that horns make everything better, because I remember reading an article on the AV Club once where they actually made a list of all the songs where good songs ruined by otherwise bad saxophone solos or something. Like for instance, like the National Anthem by Radiohead, which is a really kind of moody, you know, repeating bass line song, and then all of a sudden there's like a really whacked out saxophone solo like two-thirds of the way through. I don't know. I love the AV Club. I totally recommend reading all their stuff, because, you know, if you don't know, they're like the Onion's, you know, popular media review culture zeitgeist
thing.
Except not
thing. Satirical. Except, not right. explicitly satirical.
Yeah, and, you know, for legit. All right, that's cool. You is that all you want to talk
yeah,
about?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. All right, so for me, haven't been playing a lot of games lately, mainly because I've been working on the music for this podcast.
Add some horns to that shit.
Yeah.
Totally.
I will add some. I'll think about adding some horns.
Oh, that's what you
should do. Crazy saxophone for no reason.
and a gong, maybe. Gongs always, people love gongs at the end.
Butt Rock Saxophone is my new band.
Okay.
Maybe it's the name of my, no, it's the name of my autobiography.
Butt Rock Saxophone
yeah.
Solo?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've been working on that, you know, by the time you hear this, it will have already been in the podcast, but just so you know, I've been working on it as of now. But speaking of music, you know, I really like video game music, although I kind of hate that, you know, nom de plume, because that immediately kind of shortchanges it, you know, kind of
trivializes it,
pigeonholes it, saying, oh, you know, well, it's good as far as video game music mm-hmm. is, which most people think of as not being that great. Although definitely in the last 10 years, you know, the fact that, you know, real orchestras do music for games and get on in the game, not just in a concert afterward, which is another whole crazy thing that's popular now that didn't used to be. But yeah, I like video game music. I can get into a video game if for nothing else than the fact that it has good music sometimes. Like, that is a make it or break it moment for me. Speaking of which, I've been listening to the Fez soundtrack pre-order, which is brilliant. It's like 6 out of 25 songs. The real thing comes out in a week. It's by Disasterpiece, also known as Rich Vreeland, who I think he's like a Boston-based musician, plays the guitar, does a lot of chiptune video game soundtracks. He's pretty well known in the industry, but I heard an album of his a while ago that really got me into him. I think it was called Neutralite. I don't know what it is about it. I had already listened to lots of chiptune music before I heard him, but when I heard his stuff, it just blew me away. Like, he really likes not repeating himself, and he's very strong melodies, and he loves doing stuff in odd time signatures, and I don't know. It just, it really gets stuck in your head, but also satisfies the, like, inner, you know, prog rock musician inside of me, but still being accessible. So I've been listening to his soundtrack. I've also been listening to, The Mini Bosses. They actually put out, you know, they were one of the very first game cover bands ever, probably the first one anybody ever heard of.
Classic.
I actually saw them in concert once in LA at some place called The Smell.
nice.
It was, you know, basically like a
That's
warehouse.
An excellent club name.
You know, like the fucking Champs opened for them. You know, this is the kind of level of like notoriety they had at the time. But, you know, they're super popular and been on like lots of tech shows and probably concerts in real places that aren't named after things that sound unpleasant. But they have a new album. They actually only have 2 albums out. They've been playing since like 2005 and they only have 2 albums out, which is ridiculous. But their newest one, their first one was called Brass, and it's just video game covers, just all different kinds, Castlevania, Super Mario, Metroid, whatever. Their new one is called Brass 2 : Mouth.
Huh.
Now, say that without pausing and you'll get the joke. It's very, very mature. Anyway, it's very good. Lots more. They have like a 12-minute Kid Icarus medley that's great. They do Super Mario Bros. 3. They actually have like 9 tracks on it that are all just the Excitebike theme, done in
wow.
different styles. Like, you know, butt rock, electronica, Aphex Twin, you know, like neo, like folk. It's really weird. There's just a bunch of like 20-second songs.
It's very
Excitebike
high concept.
Theme. It is. Yeah. It's like Excitebike the album plus a Kid Icarus medley. I don't know.
So Mini Bosses are really the most definitive chiptune band, right?
Like, they're, like, well, they're not chiptune.
They're not a chiptune band.
They are
at all.
A video game rock cover band. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like, what do you call that?
I think Onomatoguchi are the definitive chiptune band.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they also have,
or maybe
like,
the best, the most well-known.
Yeah, they also have live instrumentation, though. Yeah. Like, when I think of chiptune, I think of just completely...
Exclusively.
So there's no catchy word for what minibosses do.
Good.
Video game cover band.
Yeah, video game cover band. Cover. Right. Like they're a rock band that plays video game covers.
Yeah.
You know? So, anyway, I've been listening to them. They're really good. I would recommend them. And I just also wanted to mention something since you brought up TV. The Office... I know you guys all watch The Office. Are you caught up?
No.
Okay.
I stopped watching The Office after
Michael left.
Michael left, yes.
Okay. Have you been keeping
yeah,
up on
I'm probably like two episodes behind.
Okay. I don't really... I mean, I'm not going to talk about necessarily the content of an episode, but...
You may certainly spoil Office episodes.
Yeah. There's not a lot to spoil in Office. But both Robin and I, my wife Robin, we had a discussion after, like, we watched like the last three in a row, and I think we might be actually finally coming around to the fact that either we don't really like the show that much, or
I can't believe you're coming to that right now,
or that our expectations really have to change for how we, you know, view it. Because I used to think of The Office as being like must see TV, and now it's kind of like we likened it to like a boat. I think Robin said it was like a ship that, you know, the wheel has been, you know, broken or it's disengaged, and half the crew has like literally committed suicide by jumping off the ship.
This is a dark metaphor.
And they're just kind of like out in the middle of the ocean, like kind of rocking back and forth, having no fucking clue what they're doing. Like it's like an experimental petri dish, that show now. You know, they just don't know what they have, no direction. It's just like, it's, you know, it's a show about an office. So how can it end? When either the office closes or everybody leaves or everybody dies. You know, I don't think everybody's going to die. I don't think everybody's going to leave.
That would be really dark for network TV. Oh my God. Really, it's like a gunman comes in and slaughters everyone.
This is a severe tragedy.
Well, you know, maybe Dwight will finally go completely insane and just murder everyone. Anyway, I don't know. I feel bad because I think this used to be one of my favorite shows, and I'm just, you know, I kind of wish they would have taken the hint of like British TV, where the shorter episodes, shorter seasons make so much more sense.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that.
They're just spinning their wheels.
What you're describing is basically inevitable, no matter how good any show is.
Right, but they don't
American
know when
TV,
to stop is the problem.
Because American TV, they just keep making more of it and more of it because they need to like monetize it as much as possible.
Right.
They need to make 20-something episodes per season. Then they need to have like as many seasons as they can, you know?
Right.
They'd love to have 20 seasons of really popular shows.
Like The Simpsons.
Because it's easier to just keep making the same thing instead of risking brand new things.
Would you rather have your television state-sponsored like the BBC, you communist?
So most people had that feeling with Office a couple seasons ago, like maybe even the third season or something. Michael started just getting on everybody's nerves, and it got in this cycle of not coming up with anything new. So honestly, I felt that way a couple seasons ago, but this season I like a lot. I like everything since James Spader has been back on. I love the episodes with Will Ferrell, although most people hated them. And then the new crazy lady in charge of the office,
Nellie,
very, very recently. She's pretty fun. I like what they're doing with the new people. I'm glad they're bringing new characters, but I understand your sentiment.
Yeah. I don't think it's... an unusual sentiment by this point. I'm probably a little late to the bandwagon, but anyway. All right. So that's pretty much all I got. I'm definitely going to be playing a lot of Fez. So, which, kind of leads us into, our next topic. Do we want to talk about Fez? Cause since it just came out yesterday, we've all played it for at least, you know, an hour or more. We kind of we have some thoughts
before we talk about our experience actually playing the game yet.
Okay.
I want to talk about leading up to the game. And why, like, everyone's so excited about it.
There was a long lead up to this game.
Yeah, it's been in development for like 5 years.
This is a game I've been excited about for a very long time from the first screenshot I saw. But I love games of this type. I loved Cave Story, Knit Stories, Within a Deep Forest, Syra, all the Niflis stuff, basically.
Indie platformers,
everything that's similar to... Yeah, but they're usually indie PC, free, downloadable type things.
Right.
Just platform, Metroidvania, explore, side-scrolling, find things, unlock doors, mm-hmm. right?
Push a controller, push buttons.
I just love that genre, and I love everything in it. And this is, looks basically like that, plus a little bit of 3D sideways thing going on. Basically exactly what Crush, the concept they did in Crush, which is a PSP game that probably is underrated. Mm-hmm. Not enough people have experienced that. So this, I guess, is taking that idea and making it a bit more mainstream.
Yeah, and they did a similar trick in... Super Paper Mario,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Or 1-Bit Ninja on iOS, where you can move what is a 2D thing around and see the.
Isn't there also stuff. There's also Puzzler on PSP that's
I don't know that one.
Echo Chrome.
Echo Chrome.
Yeah. Isn't that a similar kind of you use the rotation?
Yeah.
You're playing with the rotation.
Yeah.
So it's not a new mechanic.
But I think it was when he started, but the long development time has kind of let everybody else get their shit out first before he even finished his.
Well, I think like Paper Mario.
That's hard to say.
That was some of the GameCube game.
I think some people have played with it since he started.
And Crush is pretty old. I don't think he started this before Crush.
But. Paper Mario, the Thousand Year Door was like GameCube.
Okay.
Yeah. But,
whatever.
Yeah. But he is putting all these things, you know, a really good soundtrack on top. I don't know exactly what is bringing everyone to the table. I've definitely been excited about it, but I'm kind of heartwarmed by everyone else being excited about it too. Yeah, the soundtrack is great. Maybe that's bringing some people in, or maybe just
definitely got me interested.
Some good YouTubes or Vimeo videos that have spread around.
Well, yeah, especially the one people. Where it was literally like a minute and a half of just the camera slowly rotating while the music plays. I mean, how many games have a trailer like that? None.
Like, it was really well done.
Yeah, and you wouldn't think that would be like super popular because no one ever does that, but it really works with this game. But go ahead.
I've been really avoiding as much press about it as I can, although I did watch that video, for example. I'm really glad I was behind on the chat from you this week, and I started playing before you spoiled a concept to me about they're basically, and this isn't
about it rotating
a normal spoiler. This is like
spoiler
me avoiding all information about games I know I'm gonna play. Spoiler, just that you said the whole game doesn't have enemies and bosses and stuff, which I didn't want to know, and I'm glad I started playing first. That's cool.
Yeah, you're sorry. I guess that sort of
has hazards.
It didn't really seem like a spoiler, because I think it's kind of describing what the game is.
I have a whole new level of spoiling
do.
For games I'm really excited about.
Well, remember when we went and got
Josh, the Fez is because of the hat he wears.
I'm really glad I didn't know that. I was so stoked in one of those opening scenes where like your grandfather, some old guy, gives you his Fez or...
Yeah.
The moment where you get the Fez was good.
The moment when you pick up anything in the game is like, you know, Zelda level, like, da-na-na-na, kind of... Anyway, sorry, were you done with your thought?
Nah, it's a great game, whatever.
Charles, do you...
I likewise think that it's really good. I think that this is not going to be a game that I 100%, like, totally perfect.
I'm so 100%ing it.
Yeah, I can tell. But you love
yeah, you're a completionist,
I don't think Josh is a completionist necessarily, but...
Not in everything.
Not in everything.
Stuff that I like.
I tend to think of completionists as, like... I 1,000-point gamer score every game
that
touches my Xbox.
It's a spectrum.
Yeah, it's a spectrum. And I have been that way with certain games. But I think I'll play this game to whatever like sort of ending, quote unquote, that it has. But I know that the developers have been quoted as saying, like, you know, we expect that 80% of people will not see everything that there is to see. Like the vast majority of people aren't going to see everything, and I'm sure I'm going to be in that. That's because ultimately it's if you really break it down and get sort of reductive about it, it's kind of a little bit floaty mechanically. It's not the tightest performing platformer in the world. And what it has going for it is the art style and the music and the kind of the ephemera around the game, not the gameplay itself. Right. I mean, there have been other games that have done that mechanic and it does it well. And it's fun, but I don't think I love it as much as you guys do. I put it in the category of games that I really like, but I'm not like super in love. And maybe I will be by the time I play more. But
so far, my impression is that you can get the gist of the whole game in about the first 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to have like this really a narrative arc, a really strong narrative arc that, I mean, it might be pulling a Portal thing, because there are some really interesting things that have come up so far as I'm playing. So it might pull this, like, emergent story that pieces itself together as you get closer to 100%, and it might have some really cool ending or something, but not necessarily. What I'm really just, I'm hoping for that, but I'm really just expecting it to be the interesting puzzle, collect them all, find the more difficult secrets. And I think that's very fulfilling.
The writing is really good.
Writing's good.
The writing is fun. Like, it's cute. All the little, you know, conversation pieces that you have with the other players, or not players, but the NPCs in the world.
It's definitely polished. You can tell he's been working on it.
Yeah. I just want to start off by saying what I said in a recent tweet, which is, Fez is a great game on two distinct levels. One, it's an immensely appealing piece of art or work of art. And two, it's
games
a game...
can't be art.
Yeah, that's a later episode, Ebert. This is a game that your 5-year-old self has been waiting 25 years to play. Now, what I mean by that is, it's sort of like, it looks and plays and feels like a game that even a 5-year-old might like, because it's pretty simple gameplay. You know, yes, the rotation of the screen is, you know, a little more high level concept, but even if you didn't even do any puzzles, even if you literally just jumped around and it was kind of like a playground, yeah, you know, it's just, you know, I don't want to get hyperbolic on it, because I'm really, you know, it's not like I think it's the best game that has ever existed. But yes, I remember seeing it 5 years ago and getting excited about the gameplay mechanic, and the art style is cute. You know, just the cute little animals that are floating around, you know, it just has this like amazingly good vibe.
It definitely draws you in.
Yeah. And the music, yeah, you know, I've already talked about how much I love the composer who wrote the music. His style is great. This is actually even a little bit different for him. It's a much more less bombastic and more meditative than he often does. He likes to do something a little more epic, a little more, you know, I mean, he's got some progressive rock tendencies to him, and this is definitely some restrained, you know, like ambient music, but it's still really good. And yeah, you know, when I first, you know, 10 minutes into the game, I got to this new area and I put the controller down and I just sat and I just watched it, much like that video, and saw the colors slowly going from day to night and back to day, and the music, and watching like this little frog jump around, and he's just kind of, he's like facing one way and facing another way, just doing this repetition, you know, repetitive like animation, and the bunny is walking around and the bird is flying, and you can see some stuff in the background, like another building that you're going to get to. It's got almost like a mythical quality, even though I'm sure I'm reading more into it than I need to. But I don't know whether it's as deep as I feel it could be or is. It works. It portrays that, whether it's as deep, just like what Josh said, you know, even if it has no emotional arc, it feels like it could. It feels like you could invent one around what's happening, even if there is no specific one. But yeah, it just kind of has everything I like in a game, you know, a highly iconic graphical style, a great soundtrack, and, you know, simplistic yet fun gameplay. You know, I did one puzzle so far, which was actually kind of tough and took me a good 15 minutes to kind of like wrap my mind around it. Yeah, which is great. So it looks like a kid's game, but it definitely doesn't play like one. So, yeah, I remember seeing the first screenshot of this game was a lot like seeing the first screenshot of Braid. I remember when Braid was first announced, when no one knew who Jonathan Blow was or his game or anything, and him describing the concept of it, it sounded like the most craziest thing I've ever heard. Like, no one has ever done a game like that. And then years later, after you forgot about it, it finally comes out, everybody plays it. It's one of the sweetest games that has ever existed from a relative unknown person. And this guy, Phil Fish, you know, I'm not sure if he's done other games, but if he has, you know, they're not known, and this is like his
party piece.
Yeah,
coming out.
Yeah, this is his iconic release that people are going to remember him by for a while. So, you know, kudos, Phil. You know, even though, yeah, and I don't know if we really want to get into the controversy around Phil Fish, because for me,
what is the controversy?
Well, he said, I forget whether it was like GDC or some kind of gathering where people were around. He said, which it's kind of out of context, I'm sure, but in general, he said that all Japanese games suck.
Oh, he's the one who said that. Okay, yeah, and, I did hear about
and
that.
And I know he's backpedaled and kind of like, you know, retconned what he was really saying about that. And apparently there was a Japanese game designer in the room at the time, and he apparently like lost an entire night's sleep over this because he was so mortified by the concept or by his statement. And I think they've made up, or, you know, it's... Basically, it's one of those internet things where, you know, we all say lots of dumb things that are kind of inflammatory, but we don't get them.
Fuck your mother.
Yeah, like that. Except no one's going to hear this and take it out of context and then vilify me for the rest of my life.
Yes,
or you. Uh-huh. But they did him. And I think, you know, a lot of people thought he was just shitting all over a huge
industry. It's interesting because
industry.
That game has a total Japanese vibe. Like, I was playing it, and my wife was in the room. I, too, am married, podcast listeners. And
sorry, guys. Yeah. Or girls, whatever.
Sorry, species.
Wash your mouth out.
And she asked me, is this a Japanese game?
Wow.
She was just kind of watching me play it. And I was like, no, it's not. But it kind of has that vibe. It has. And maybe it's because the last time she played, really, like... played games on a regular basis was the kind of 16-bit era, yeah. So it like felt like that, and Japanese games were way more prominent then, and it does have, but it has that kind of feel to it,
yeah.
Right? The kind of more conceptual, you know, the details are so good, the little the constellations in the sky are Tetris pieces,
yes.
Right? It's such a cute touch. The fact that the music is relative to the music is being heard by your little avatar, by Gomez. Right,
mm-hmm.
And if you rotate away from Gomez, you hear a muted down. It cuts out the treble on the music, and you only hear the bass line because he's the one who's hearing it. You're not hearing it, and then you rotate back around, and that's when you can hear the full range of the music. Like all those little touches, I think are super cute, and it's that kind of attention to detail that feels very Japanese to me.
Well, and even the art style immediately reminds me of Cave Story. Just, I mean, it almost feels like that guy is a huge, huge fan of Cave Story, and you know, kind of not aped it, but, you know, a lot of the same kind of concepts of these tiny little sprites with cute animation that, you know, so.
Yeah, I wasn't there. I don't know if he was just misspeaking and didn't really mean it, because he obviously does have a lot of respect for a bunch of Japanese
games. He's just a self-hater.
Including his influences and stuff. You know, whether he just misspoke or whether he was, you know, really overreaching because
we don't like to do research on this podcast, just in case you were curious. We don't really want to find out what the context was. It's more fun this way.
Because there are, I mean, obviously a lot of Japanese developers are pretty behind right now and not keeping up with the latest trends and necessarily coming up with really great new ideas. But some still are. I mean, Dark Souls is phenomenal and takes a lot of old concepts in gaming and blends them with some new and makes this just unbelievable hybrid. And obviously Nintendo is still kicking some Marios out of the park and stuff like that. So
yes,
you can't make
no
any
one knows
universal
how
statements.
To deliver on a concept like Nintendo. Like no one knows how to do fan service as well as Nintendo. And they make games that are Nintendo first party games are just like almost always incredibly great. Those Mario Galaxy games are so good, right? Zelda, particularly for Zelda fans, is usually incredible. Although you hate the most
Don't
recent
say that.
Zelda, but
all
I think
the most,
that they
all
just
the recent Zeldas.
You didn't even like any of the Wii Zeldas.
Everything since 3D.
Yeah,
N64. You know, everyone's 10.0 game. What was it? Was that called Link to the Past?
No, Ocarina of Time.
Ocarina of Time.
Mm-hmm.
Horrible.
Yeah, I tried to play it on the virtual store, whatever it's called on the Wii, I couldn't get past 5 minutes of it, mainly just because that transition between the sprite 16 base games to the PlayStation 2 era polygonal detail is ugly as sin. Holy crap. Like,
yeah.
Link is like 50 polygons total, and it just...
Yeah, if you play it now, it doesn't hold up as much, but I played it in its day, and I thought Mario 64 was a great jump to 3D from 2D, but I thought that Zelda was not. I didn't like the Z targeting. I wanted dual analog. I couldn't stand the single analog on Nintendo controllers. The Z targeting just made it all the combat really simple and boring. And the world I didn't feel engaged in. The lack of textures and stuff might have been part of it. But obviously Mario and other games like that worked around it. even in its time, though, everybody was praising it, and I was really bored, and I couldn't get more than 5 or 10 hours in.
So Fez is really good.
So Fez is good. All right. Anybody have anything else they want to add? She should definitely play it. It's on Xbox Live. Get it now. It's only $10. $10 American.
I want to bring up, you know, Fez and Journey. Just,
yeah.
Okay. You know, it's also just a phenomenal downloadable game that came out only like 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys haven't played it yet, right?
Because we don't have PlayStations.
Right. It's a big problem because you guys need to play it because it's
exclusives suck.
The best thing ever.
We're not in the Nintendo world anymore. Come on.
That's true. Exclusives do suck.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Just no, they do.
Buy the consoles you need to buy to play the games that you need to play because you need to play this game or play it at my house or whatever. You can play through the whole thing once in probably less than 2 hours and get the best experience. And then if you play it through again,
you get a less than best experience.
You know, you get a very good but different, very different experience. Okay. So it's worth playing through all the way through at least twice. But yeah, come over, play it. It's so good. It's a man, been looking forward to that one for a long time.
All right, so that's Fez. All right, do we want to do DLC or do we want to do defense of boring?
I can talk about DLC.
What about you, Charles?
I can talk about both.
All right, let's do DLC. I'll start you off. So DLC, what's the deal? With C.
What's the DLC?
What's the DLC, Josh? Okay, so you wanted to bring up
I want to say a few different things.
But it exists, and there are issues.
So my primary point is that I don't understand what people's problem is with like getting angry at companies for the way they release DLC.
I can totally explain this to you.
Well, first of all, Josh.
Please do so in a moment.
Wait, hold on, Josh.
After I explain how nonsensical it is.
Okay, before you do that, though, define what your concept of what DLC is or should be.
Well, like, there are different types.
Okay, saying, well then tell the different types.
I'm saying there can be any type that a company wants to release. Uh-huh. Like, can't you just decide if a product is worth its price and then say whether or not it's worth its price? You know?
Yeah.
Like, if a game is $60 but you think it's worth $40, then just say that in your review and then don't buy it until it goes down in price. Right, and if a DLC is $10, and you feel like it should have been worth $5, say that. Or you feel like it was actually worth $15, or it was totally worth its value, say that. But does it really matter whether it was on the disc or whether it was downloaded?
Yeah, whether
you download a 100K file or a 100 megabyte file, does that matter at all? Also, does it matter whether or not the developer created it before or after the release of the game? Does that matter at all?
I think it
can. What if they had different people working on it? Does that matter? What if it was the same people and they took a portion of the game and said, we're not releasing this until 2 months later? Why does that matter? Why do people get angry about that?
I agree with your argument that, you know, if you don't think that the game as it is sold is worth the money, then you shouldn't buy it. You should wait till it's cheaper and get it then, right? And I think that's totally reasonable. I don't think many people would disagree with that. But I think that the argument people are making is that before DLC was possible, game developers would make a complete game and it would be on the disc. And then once DLC became possible, they started making complete games and then working on DLC and releasing it subsequently. And now we're at a point where DLC is part of the strategy from the beginning. And this is the argument they're making. I don't necessarily agree with it. I think they would say that with DLC part of the strategy, not all the resources of the game developer are going toward making the game as good as it possibly can be. Some of them are going toward making the DLC. And so, therefore, we are getting a watered-down product relative to what we would have gotten had DLC not been a part of it. I think that's basically what people are saying.
So, I disagree with your premise. I think that games, you know, 10 or 15 years ago or whatever, before DLC, were often shipped and felt incomplete. And if they felt incomplete, they got a bad review,
mm-hmm.
right? And
Can you give us an example of a game that shipped that you felt just was incomplete?
Just go look up bad reviews from 10 years ago.
Well, but, but incomplete it's does not mean bad, necessarily.
It's probably games that you didn't play because they weren't good.
No example. Your point is flawed.
Yeah, well, because the thing is that I don't think incomplete equals bad. I don't think that a bad game
a
is
game
incomplete.
A game that got a bad review
doesn't
is
mean
not
it was,
necessarily because
I'm it was
not
incomplete.
100%, but I'm saying there must have been some. And if you want me to go dig through examples this week, I will. But
no, don't
I'm
do research.
Come up with
no,
them
don't research this. I only care what you can think of off the top of your head.
Well,
which is nothing.
You'll
apparently
get me every single time. Okay. Because I can't think of examples of anything because I have a terrible memory.
All right,
but there are definitely games that got bad reviews before DLC that felt incomplete. Mm-hmm. I'll look up the examples if you need me to. But now you got me all off track.
Well, it's because your argument is incomplete, much like the games you're talking about in which you have no examples of. This is more fun if we disagree. You get that, right? Sorry, go ahead.
What was the second half of your point?
that DLC changes the whole strategy of how they make games.
Yeah, that when DLC is
whether or not the money
part
is
of
allocated
the strategy
first,
from right. the yeah, the resources.
Whether or not like they decided to budget a certain amount for DLC or not, that could be a completely separate issue of how much they budgeted for the game in the first place. Mm-hmm. Like if they budget $2 million for a game and $500,000 for a DLC, that doesn't mean that they would have spent $2.5 million on the original game if they didn't have the DLC.
Sure,
option.
I know it doesn't, but
right?
I think somebody's argument would be that they could have.
Yeah, but yeah. Could isn't
well
necessarily.
I mean, you're basically saying we can't know what they would have done, and I agree, we can't know what they would have done. But they if they had $2.5 million and they spent $2 million and not the full 2.5, then
okay, let me,
you could argue.
Okay,
that
let
the
me
game
throw
is,
the opposite argument back at you. Uh-huh. Which games are incomplete right now?
I'm not saying
what games
that
have
I'm making
come out, like what games have come out recently are incomplete because
I think
they're
the
holding
one
stuff back for
that
DLC.
Gets the most hate, you know, going back to the fighting game thing, is like the Street Fighter 4, right? Street Fighter 4 came out, then a bunch of individual DLC characters came out. They were on the characters were on the disc because if you don't do that, then not everybody has the characters to play against.
Right.
So they have to be included in that fashion, and I think that rankles people. Like,
and I think that it shouldn't rankle people because they did that for the advantages that it provides, which are that, you know, they don't force the people that bought this disc without those extra characters to not be able to play.
Look, ultimately, it's just business, right? Like, Capcom in releasing that game knows that the people who buy Street Fighter 4 day one and really love the genre, really love the game, are going to buy all the DLC characters, and so they can sell them all to them for an individually higher price, and then they release a collection game, which they did, which had all the DLC characters on the disc. It's like effectively the same thing. It's just you don't need to purchase the unlock codes for each of them, and so they're just doing it to make money, which is fine. They're a corporation that needs to make profit, but I think that, you know, the argument that you would have made before is or that people who kind of dislike this would make is that, you know, they did all the work up front, the characters were done, you know, whether or not it came out of a separate operating budget is sort of immaterial to somebody who's buying the game. It's like, I'm getting a game that is, you know, broken. It's like the speed limiter on a car. Like, I can't use all the performance of the car because they locked it down from the factory. I think that just pisses people off. I'm not saying they're right, and I think fundamentally I agree with your overarching point, which is that a game is worth what you're willing to pay for it, and if you don't think it's complete when it comes out, then don't buy it.
So fighting games do tend to take the brunt of this argument, and maybe it's because their consumers are often the same immature jerks that are popular in the pro fighting game.
That's right. We insult fighting gamers and shit on Ocarina of Time here.
Yep, that's all I do.
Escort mission.
Eat it. Find your own way to point B.
But what I'm saying is, like, the fighting game developers can't win. Like, right? Which method of release could they possibly do that would make people happy? There isn't one.
Well, yeah, there is. They release everything with no DLC. Done. Game over. They release
everything for free forever.
No, not for free. Just the game with all characters unlocked. None of this like piecemeal DLC bullshit.
What do they do after that?
What do you mean after that? They make another game after that.
Yeah, but is it a sequel that they release like 2 years later?
That's how it all used to work. There was Street Fighter and then Super Street Fighter.
And Madden every year. What I'm saying is if they did that, their customers wouldn't be happy because there would be this 2 year break in between every release.
Dude, it's a fighting game. Do you really need a new fighting game every 6 months? Like, freaking play Super Street Fighter 2 for a few years. That's what we used to do back when it was just in the arcade. I think it's a sense of entitlement and raised expectations that is kind of it's kind of a symbiotic relationship. Like, you know, we as players get a little more entitled because maybe they tried something new and like, oh, now they're going to start doing it more often, or now they're going to put these extra characters on the disc. I'm not going to have to wait 3 years for a new game. And then you start thinking that's how it should always be done. And then they're like, well, people are interested in this. Well, let's lock a few characters off and make some more bucks on this. You know, it's kind of a back and forth double-edged sword where they put out more stuff and we get more entitled. So they have to keep putting out more stuff. And whenever they backpedal, there's a backlash.
So let's talk about a game we actually play because we don't play a lot of fighting games.
Yeah, why are we talking about fighting games? I haven't played a fighting game in 10 years.
To argue about fighting games that we don't play. But
so Mass Effect.
So in Mass Effect...
what game?
So in Mass Effect, let's talk about the Javik DLC. Mm-hmm, okay. I think it's one of the best examples of DLC ever. It's phenomenal because what the game is without it is it's a complete game. Mm-hmm. It's a good game. Mike, you experienced
the whole game. I agree. Yeah, I did not get the DLC.
Without the DLC, and it wasn't broken.
Right.
Right? Agreed. But it was, quote, missing this character.
Right.
And a mission and some extra dialogue scenes and such. And to me, what that is, releasing it on day one and developing it concurrently with the main game, and maybe even, let's say, that it was created as part of the game and they decided to rip it out. Let's say they decided to pull mm-hmm. this character out mm-hmm. and all his dialogue and his mission and stuff and say, we can charge money for this. Theoretical worst case scenario, the people that might be angry with them for it. The game is complete without it. It's not broken. And the people that just want to play it, get through it, beat it, and aren't like 100% completionists, don't love the game so much they want to talk to every single character after every single mission on the ship and you know, experience everything Mass Effect there is to experience. Those people are happy with their purchase. They complete the game. It lasts them 30 hours still or whatever, right? Or at least 20. But the folks that are really into Mass Effect and want as much Mass Effect as they can get, you know, there's opportunities to get more Mass Effect. Instead of just waiting for another sequel, like I get a longer, more thorough, fleshed out Mass Effect experience with my original Mass Effect 3 playthrough by paying them $10 extra and getting this extra character and mission and stuff. And then I am the type that after every mission, I talk to every character on the ship, and then my game maybe lasts 40 hours instead. And I am willing to pay that premium for the longer, more thorough experience, and I think that's brilliant. And I don't understand why everybody's so angry at BioWare.
Are people
for
angry?
DLC.
There are people who are pissed off because I actually think that was a one that they handled pretty well in that situation because clearly it is a character that they had to think about throughout the whole process. It wasn't one that they could have done as subsequent to completing the game. And I think what they did, which was smart, is that DLC. Wasn't DLC if you buy the collector's edition. It's just the game.
Right.
And it is DLC. So I think that kind of took the edge off it for most people. I wasn't aware that there's like a backlash about that particular DLC.
So let's compare that to fighting games.
Yeah.
Right. If they develop these extra characters simultaneously when they're developing a fighting game mm-hmm. and then they want to release them either day one or a month later or whatever, when they develop it concurrently, they get to integrate it and balance it and test it mm-hmm. more thoroughly yep. with, or save costs maybe by just not doing it afterwards. So why is there a problem with that?
Well, I think with fighting, again, this is whatever, we don't play fighting games, but I think there's a tendency for the DLC characters to be more powerful. And it is like imbalanced if you don't have that character. So they sort of build in an incentive for everyone to, like, the top tier, like, really, like, Akuma would never have been, right? Akuma wasn't part of the original Street Fighter roster. The people, basically, there's creep. Like with cars, the next, you know, the 2013 model of a car is probably going to be a little bit bigger and a little bit, you know, more horsepower and a little bit more engine. Like, there's just scope creep with fighting game characters as time progresses. Right,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
But let's talk about one you guys disagree with in Mass Effect. At the end of the credits, not only at the end of the credits, after the ending sequence,
yes,
after the credits, after this epilogue little scene that you get to see after the credits, if you stick around that long, when it's finally
little
over.
Little dialogue box.
Instead of having a the end screen, or I don't know what you guys expected, but instead of just dropping you back to the main menu, which is what I think, you guys would have found acceptable, is dropping you to the main menu. Right before they drop you to the main menu, they have a little dialogue box that says, okay, now please continue to enjoy Mass Effect and, furthering Shepard's legacy, you know, generic statement, and, you know, we're going to release some DLC at some point. It said something like that.
Yep.
I don't understand what you guys found distasteful about that.
I'm not sure. I don't know if distasteful is the right word, but it was fairly immersion breaking, and it was also
immersion breaking.
It was kind of tactless, and it was also kind of unnecessary.
Is dropping you to the main menu immersion breaking?
No.
The game's over.
Right, and I think I think that would have been okay if it would have just gone back to the title screen.
Fade to black and leave you at black for another half an hour. Is that not immersion breaking? Is that what you wanted?
I just said going back to the main menu would have been fine. Like, I think that dialogue box was completely unnecessary and was like, it was like I was in a Windows program all of a sudden and a dialogue box popped up
This is my question. How is that dialogue box any more immersion breaking than being at the main menu?
Forget immersion breaking. That's totally unnecessary. It was like, doesn't matter. The point is that was, like, that doesn't happen anywhere else in the game. That little modal UI element, I cannot remember another instance of that in the entire game. Like, it's the only time that thing ever pops up, it ever pops up like a window and says anything. And the fact that it says there's DLC coming, like, everybody knows there's DLC coming. You don't have to say it. It seems tactless. It seemed out of character because
I don't think
it's not really going to help them. It's not going to sell more DLC. The fact that they popped that up, right? If all they popped up literally was, thanks for playing, right? Everything except the and continuing Shepard's story through the DLC packs that we're releasing. If they had everything except the DLC mention, I would have been like, that's a little weird, but who cares? But the fact that they mentioned DLC felt so like Disney. It felt like
it was like something
like a used car salesman.
It was
or
like
something
that EA
skeezy.
Dropped in at the 12th. Or the 11th hour, mm-hmm. right before it went in the box. Like, oh, damn, you know, the accounting or the marketing people say, we got to put this dialogue box in about DLC, so let's throw a dialogue box that doesn't appear anywhere else in the game at the last possible second.
So are you not looking forward to the DLC?
But, yes, of course. Of course,
you
I am.
You are looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I for the record, I'm definitely not as, like, crazy amped about Mass Effect, so I don't really care one way or another.
Is the tasteless part because of the implication of wanting more money from you?
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay, so
they're shilling for DLC on the main menu all the time. So I know you have DLC. Get over it.
So you do know that, like, both the DLCs that they've announced so far are free.
You're being hyper rational about this. Like, it's an emotional reaction. It's like, F you guys. Like, I know there's DLC. You don't have to pop up a window at the end of the game.
They're releasing the DLC for free.
They
it's going to be
done.
Free.
Yes. No, it's not all the DLC is going to be free.
Both DLCs so far, the multiplayer one that
have
came out and the story one that they said is coming this summer, both of them are free. Like,
that doesn't change my feelings about them popping up.
Well, but the Javik one isn't free.
Right, but they couldn't be referring to the Javik one in that with that dialogue.
But they did charge you for DLC.
Well, and the ending one is probably only free because the internet, you know, blew a gasket. They probably thought about charging for it.
Oh, we'll never know. But I would argue that they're going to make the same one they were already.
Well, you know, I think it's regardless, or regardless of the price or not of the DLC, it was a weird dialogue box that appears nowhere else. So UI, you know, hypersensitivity wise, it was just weird and dumb and noticeable, which when the whole point is that you don't want to notice that you're playing
a game.
It made it a game really quickly. Like, oh, I'm playing a game and I'm going through dialogue boxes. Okay. Well, that's great. Sure.
So personally,
it doesn't break the game, but it's just stupid.
Personally, I found it reassuring. And
because you were anxious until that point whether there was going to be further adventures.
Because I didn't want this epic experience to be over. And I was like, okay, where do I go from now?
Didn't know where to go from there.
Yeah, how do I get more of this? When do I get more of this? Is this really, really over now?
Which it doesn't tell you at all.
The news feed on the title screen, which is ever present, you never saw any time during playing the game.
I'm not saying I'm an idiot.
I think that's what you're saying.
You're getting very emotional.
Emotionally now. Yeah. Uh-huh. Your emotional state at the end was they're asking me for money. Fuck you guys. And my emotional state at the end was, oh my God, that was an amazing experience. I want more of this. When and how can I get more of this? And instead of saying, now you can start a new game plus, right? Which a million games do with a little dialogue box that says, here, go back and start a new game plus. Mm-hmm. Like, instead of saying that, they say, well, you can keep playing if you want. Like, and then they drop you before the final mission. I don't think that's too much of a spoiler. Or you can play some DLC when it comes out. Like, this is where you go from now. It's answering that question that a player has when they're done, after the credits, after the final sequence. It's just a logical dialogue box. I think it's very, very similar to dialogue boxes at the end of any game.
You know, maybe it would have been better if it just wasn't a dialogue box, because the game itself, you know, all of the normal places where dialogue boxes would be in like 16-bit RPGs mm-hmm. would be, that's where the dialogue boxes were, when you're talking to someone, like your name and what you say. And this game was all about being cinematic.
You're right. You know, that's actually
like,
exactly
that dialogue
right.
box was like incredibly non-cinematic,
cheesy,
almost as if like
if it were the last part of the title scroll or the credit scroll, like if it was just a block of text that came up in the credit scroll and that was the last thing it saw and then it faded out and went
that,
back
that would have been less
I would
noticeable.
Have been way less right. pissed about it.
All right, I agree.
Yeah, nope. I'm not sure I was pissed about it, but it was so noticeable when I'm thinking this should not have been so noticeable.
Yeah.
This should not have been such a break.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is this dialogue box? This is like the most generic, stupid message they could have said when this whole game is a cinematic orgy of craziness. And then they give me a dumb dialogue box at the end? Who the hell made this decision? That's basically what I was thinking. But
well, speaking of cinematic orgies of craziness, to put in a segue there.
Do you want to do what? I don't know what that means.
And am I not? That's segueing into Defensive Boring.
Oh, okay. So, Defensive Boring. Just the background on this. A blogger. Once again, I don't do research.
I actually have research.
You have research on
I
this
have
guy.
The quote.
Well, I just want to say it's by this guy named Tom Augsier, from NightmareMode.net. He wrote an article, and Charles has some background on this.
This is the quote that might lead us into the discussion. He says, I'm all about video games not wasting my time. If I made a list of pet peeves, that would be number one on my list. But grinding doesn't have to ruin our time in a game. Properly placed, it can enhance it. It's a meditative series of moments tucked into the heart of a game, and it gives us time to think about what comes next. So his argument essentially, and the kind of overall thread of this argument, is that there's a place for slowness in games. And I think, Mike, you were pointing out that if he had just... in Defense of Boring is a better headline than, you know, pace your games well, developers.
Right.
But that's basically what he's arguing. And he had a lot to say specifically about Mass Effect, a favorite topic here on the Escort Mission. So I don't know. What do you think? What do you think about this, Mike?
Well,
you're
Mike
the one
must
who
agree with
found
it. He's the one in Fez just paused it and
shared
the screen.
Yeah,
for an hour.
Yeah. No, I think some of his examples are, you know, because he does mention grinding, mm-hmm. which, you know, has a negative connotation. Because when you think of grinding, you think of old school RPGs that flash up a battle every 10 seconds as you're trying to get through a dungeon, and you just want to get to the boss so you can move on to the next part, and you don't want to have to keep, you know, hitting the button
to go... Or literally
to go
not being able to move on until you fight, you know, a bunch of low-level enemies.
Yeah, and, you know, that was kind of old school design, mainly by not by, I don't think by choice, but just because like that was the easiest thing to implement at the time. And so putting that in a modern game, like for example, you know, lots of people are making retro games and there's lots of retro RPGs on iOS. And there's one I played recently, I think it's called Dragon Fantasy, which was literally made to be like a Dragon Warrior / Final Fantasy, 8-bit NES game. And yeah, it has a lot of random encounters and, you
Final
know,
Final Warrior.
I like that game, but I had to stop playing because of the random encounters, of the grinding, of the necessity to fight those enemies to build up your levels so that you're strong enough to progress with the game. Modern game design tries to eschew that because they realize they have more money, more people, more time. They can make a better, you know, progression where you don't have to grind, where you can just go through the story and fight the enemies that you fight. And you don't have to backtrack and you don't have to spend an extra 20 minutes fighting enemies to be strong enough to beat the enemy because that's boring. And I think, I'm not sure if he really means that that's actually a good thing and more games should do that. I think through the course of the article, he realizes what he's saying is that, you know, not every game should be Call of Duty. Not every game should be one explosive action Michael Bay sequence to the next. Because the problem with that is that the only way to better a scene of crazy violence and action is a more crazy, more violent scene of action. Because it's sort of like with a drug where you take a hit and you have to get a bigger hit and a bigger hit and a bigger hit because you're just like...
Mike's a heroin addict.
Yeah. So it's like my addiction to Michael Bay explosion orgies of craziness scene-based games. No, you know, you need some downtime. You need the Mass Effect resource minigame because it lets you reflect on what you've been doing. You can't just fight a battle every 5 seconds. That can't be the game. It's just battle after battle after battle because you lose energy. You lose perspective. The game... You know, it's not balanced. It doesn't have, you know, if your life was literally just one long bungee jump that never ended and you never stopped.
Fucking sweet.
You never stopped bungee jumping to stop and think about how awesome that bungee jump you did was. You never really appreciate that bungee jump.
So what game didn't have enough downtime that was too...
This guy argues Mass Effect 3.
Yeah, do you agree?
Well, I think he's saying that it has moved from less RPG to more action, like they've tried to streamline it.
From more RPG to more
action. Sorry, yeah. More RPG in the early days to more action in the later days, ostensibly because that's what fans have wanted, or maybe not. I don't know. I'm not really sure that I wanted that. I liked the walking around the Citadel or, you know, doing... I know fetch quest sounds bad, but it really does break up the, you know, faux Gears of War shooting action elements, which are fun, but if that's all the game was, which I think Mass Effect 3 was more of that than it was before, I think it lost a little something. I miss the, you know, this is my favorite store on the Citadel, mm-hmm. you know, opinion, funny meme, and that, I don't think Mass Effect 3 has that. It's all action and emotion and oh my god, and tension until it, you know, you literally explode in a light beam if you choose the green energy ending.
Spoilers.
Yeah. So I don't know. You know, I mean, I think there's a place for his philosophy, but I'm not sure grinding. I don't want grinding. I don't want random encounters, but I do want
quiet spaces. Well, I totally
felt
that the Mass Effect 2 resource hunt minigame was a fucking grind, like in the exact worst sense of that term.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad.
I think that's a bad example of slow down gaming. So I don't agree that that is, we need more of that.
What's a good example of something that actually needed more downtime? Because if you're saying Mass Effect 3 needed more downtime, like I disagree. I know that the pacing in Mass Effect 3 was a bit unusual, but to me that's because at the very beginning of the game, the war starts, and then the whole game is while the war is going on, and it wouldn't make sense to have you spend all this time doing meaningless bullshit. Even the little amount of meaningless bullshit that they do have you do in the game, the fetch quests that are in there that take a little bit of time,
feels out of
place.
Like,
they don't make sense, and they feel out of place, and I think they should have been removed. I don't think there should be more of that. I think there should have been less. And as is, I think it was long enough. I think if it were a little shorter, it would still be acceptable. If they removed some of that fluff, because there was a war going on. But if you don't think about the story in Mass Effect and you just think of them as being equivalent to the previous two, one and two and three, yeah, you could make the argument that they removed all these RPG elements and made it more of an action game and removed some of the good stuff. I actually did like the Mako stuff in the first one, driving around planets and exploring. Mm-hmm. Thought that was really fun. And I was kind of disappointed they removed that completely from number two until some of the DLC and Overlord and such. But I don't think that would have made as much sense if they still had that around in three in the story. So I don't think it had a place there. I think the pacing was good, but unusual in Mass Effect 3 because of the war going on.
So yeah, you know, it's, I'm finding it hard to think of a specific example of a game.
Then I think we basically agree.
Well, I mean, okay, you could think
that there's no good place for grinding in any game.
Well, and yeah,
remove the grinding.
But I, once again, I'm not really sure he's saying that more games need random encounter grinding. I think
sounded like it. He was talking about Farmville as a good example of a fun grind or whatever.
Mike's opinion isn't exactly dovetailing with this guy's opinion.
Yeah, I don't necessarily agree with everything he's saying. I just think the philosophy of, like, let's say a Fez. I think Fez and Call of Duty are two, like, diametrically opposed games in terms of what the point of them is and what the pacing is. Like, Call of Duty is literally one crazy action set piece after another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like an action flick. And, you know, it's not that that's bad or that we shouldn't have games like that. But if every game was like that, that would suck. You know, I want Fez. I want a game that I literally want to set the controller down and just watch, like, you know, the frog jump around and the colors change. And a lot of people, I think, would say that's boring. That's a boring game. You're not interacting. It's not challenging you. You're not being like, holy crap, holy crap, holy crap, every 5 seconds. You know, that game has, like, almost no holy crap moment, at mm-hmm. least in the first hour. But that's not bad. I'm in defense of that. Of yay, let's have more of that boring gameplay.
Yeah, but the people that would disagree with you are just the people that only play Call of Duty, that just want to be in that meat grind and they don't appreciate other games like we do.
So you're saying that there's only two types of gamers, people like us that are cool and meatheads?
Yes.
That's right, people. Fuck Ocarina of Time and that other thing and now this.
And fighting games.
And fighting games and Call of Duty players. All right, how many listeners do we have left?
but yeah, I'm not. The argument that the article makes, or that, you know, you might be touching on, that maybe we all disagree with, is that all games need that downtime, and I don't think that's the case. I think we can get our fill of that slower pace from specific games, from mm-hmm. Journey and Fez, and it, you don't have to insert, you know, this inappropriate grinding or downtime in those action games necessarily.
Well, okay, so that brings up a good point. Are you saying that the ideal game, if there had to be one ideal game, would not be a game with both these Call of Duty action sequences and these Fez contemplative moments, but, you know, you'd have to have at least two games in the universe to be ideal? You'd have to have one that has all the action stuff and one that has the contemplative stuff.
No.
Like the synthesis of them is not the ideal, or no, is
we're
it?
Not fighting, we're agreeing.
Because I think the ideal game would have both.
There is a
you're
place.
You're vehemently agreeing.
Rawr!
There is a place for action games. There is a place for down-tempo games. There is a place for those that mix make some kind of hybrid.
But is that the ideal game, though, one that mixes them?
Not necessarily.
So you don't want your food to touch, ideally? Because I think the ideal game would have
not
both.
Not necessarily.
so you're not saying anything, really.
Stop putting arguments in my mouth.
All right, you know what?
Of course I'm saying something or nothing.
All right, you know, I think we need to move on past this because we spent a lot of time on this. I think we should get to our two, you know, waiting on with bated breath features that everybody loves because they've been established by one previous episode so far. Is not my thing. Something is not my thing. I'm going to leave this off, okay?
What's not your thing, Mike?
Okay. And I know this is going to sound incredibly pretentious and pedantic, but we need something to talk about. games that have the ability within them to build other whole games, especially established games, you know, other properties within them. For example, a couple examples. Minecraft is probably a big one, although it's hard to really rail against this because the whole point of Minecraft is to build stuff, which should be limitless. But, you know, I've seen people build recently. Someone built the entire Castlevania 1 game inside of Minecraft, like as if you were playing the game as much as Minecraft will allow you. Someone also built, I think, the first level of Super Mario Land from the Game Boy that, you know, was functional, like you were watching a movie of someone playing it. You know, Little Big Planet, I think, was made probably especially for this. You know, I don't have any specific example, but I'm sure someone has built a game inside Little Big Planet. And
oh yeah, plenty, lots.
Yeah, like Tetris, etc.
StarCraft 2, the engine allows you to build games, and people have made. What kind of games have they made in it?
Isn't there like Bejeweled in WoW? I think you can play Bejeweled inside of World of Warcraft.
Well, that's because Blizzard made it.
Yeah. Well, that's part of what your argument is.
I think it's more the argument of the players making these games, not so much like a mod or a DLC from the developers. You know, I'm okay. Just so I'm clear, I'm not trying to say that these people are necessarily wasting their time, because I don't really believe in the concept that, you know, time can be wasted as long as you're enjoying it. You know, I could say you wasted it, but that doesn't mean that you have. But I guess it's more like, it almost feels like a squandering of talent when someone would spend, you know, weeks and weeks and months, you know, and many people and money
just to make something that
just to make Castlevania, which already exists in a perfect form as Castlevania in Minecraft. Like, building something original, I have more, like, I think is a better, you know, time chunk to use. But it, you know, the thing is that Castlevania in Minecraft will never be as good as Castlevania as Castlevania. You know, it's just like, you know, what are you trying to prove beyond the fact that you're making something that you know is going to get, you know, a Reddit hit because people, oh, hey, Castlevania, I like that, you know, as opposed to making something original, which is harder to memeify and harder to viralize, you know, like that's why you've heard about this, because it's an established property. It almost feels like baiting, a little bit too much baiting. Like, they're not going to make their original game in it because no one cares that you made your original game in Minecraft. They care that you made Castlevania, because I love Castlevania. I'll download that. I'll like that. I'll share that. And I'm just like, I don't know. Like,
I would like to remind you that you are the person who just talked about how great. I can't remember the name of the band. Who's the band?
Mini Bosses.
Uh-huh. You love remixes and you love covers. I think it's totally bizarre that you hold this opinion. I really do, because like when it comes to music, which is super important to you, you're all over that kind of activity. You actually get mad at me that I hate the Alien Ant Farm Michael Jackson cover. You're like, no, that's totally worthwhile. I'm like, no, that's music for fucking idiots like who play Call of Duty and fighting games.
Yeah, well, I never claimed to say that my opinion was completely thought out and flawless, but that's why it's an opinion. But
I think it's a lot like artists, you know, creating a big complex piece that takes them hundreds of hours, that most viewers are just going to glance at and go, wow, look at that. You know, like I saw one time I saw in a gallery an enormous cube of beeswax and it was just this really nicely formed handmade cube of beeswax,
you know, as hand formed cubes of beeswax go.
This was a good one.
Tiny tiny little speck of beeswax to the side that indicated this is the amount of beeswax an average bee will make in its lifetime. And, well, besides that being an impressive task for the bees, it was also an impressive task for the artist, I'm sure, to assemble it. It was an imposing figure, but there are a lot of other artist examples that require more meticulous, you know, pointillism or something. And, you know, the user looks at it and goes, wow. Impressive.
The art
that
user.
Was kind of a waste of time, but that's really cool. You know, like, way to go, guy. So I really respect those endeavors. You know, in Minecraft, the guy that made the first microcontroller or whatever, the processor or memory bank, and then how far it's advanced since then with the red powder.
What's that stuff called?
Switches.
Yeah, what's redstone?
Redstone. Yeah.
Or the same type of endeavor in somebody made a first person shooter in that StarCraft thing.
Yeah, they've done crazy stuff with that engine. Yeah.
Or Tetris, et cetera, and Little Big Planet. Those, you know, I'm really impressed by those, but I definitely don't want to go out and play them. I just want to see a screenshot or a Reddit headline.
Yeah.
And if that's their intent, is to get the Reddit headline, you know, maybe the Reddit headline is the new gallery opening, right? Like,
yeah.
Who's going to appreciate that endeavor? They're not going to, you know, set a computer running that Minecraft server, running Super Mario Land or whatever into some random museum in LA or something. They're just going to put it online where you could download it yourself, maybe, or get articles on Slashdot.it or Reddit or whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, just to follow up on the versus mini bosses thing, I think in general, yeah, I mean, first of all, Josh, you touched on the fact that, like, okay, it's impressive. I mean, I'm not saying it's not impressive and it's not worthy of, like, okay, that was cool, that took a lot of time and effort, and you did a good job, but it's also Castlevania. I've played Castlevania. If I'm going to play Castlevania, I'm going to play Castlevania. And that's just me. Maybe somebody really only wants to play Castlevania as a Minecraft level, and, well, then yay for them because they got what they wanted. But for me, you know, I don't want to play Tetris in Little Big Planet. I want to play Tetris.
Even from
it's already been made. I want to play that.
Even from the beginning, though, I don't think the intent of the creator was for people to play that and enjoy it.
Yeah, I would agree.
It was just to create it.
It's the whole argument about the constraint of creativity, right? Like when you're working within a constraint, you can do something better than if you have no limits.
Yeah. It's right? Like, try to build this dragon out of only plastic forks.
Yeah, that thing is awesome.
That thing was sweet as hell. Yeah. And nobody's going to play that, or you're just going to look at it and appreciate it. And I feel like these types of projects are similar, although you could download it and play with it for a few moments. I don't think they expect you to play all the way through.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's this is why this is not entitled "This Thing Blows and Should Die." This section is called "Not My Thing."
Well, that's totally true, and I have not started using game demos relative to our last week's conversation. So yeah.
So yes, I do love the mini bosses, despite the fact that I don't really care for Castlevania and Minecraft. Yeah. That's the world I live in. Okay. Our other big, huge, amazingly popular, dripping with...
We need some grind in this. We can't go right from one awesome thing to another.
Dripping,
we
all
have
right.
to do podcast grind. 5 seconds of silence.
All right, 5 seconds. We made it 5 seconds. Is best game ever. All right. Ding, ding, ding. This is the point where we stop talking so that later on I can insert music into it and edit it, make it all awesome. If we're always talking, there's no room for me to insert stuff. That's what she said. So
I was way too easy on you last week for Fallout.
Thanks.
We can't revisit the past.
Yeah,
I know. The past is the past.
I regret it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So best game ever. I think Charles has a best game ever. You'd like to talk
I
about?
Have a best game ever, and that best game ever is StarCraft II.
Because fuck StarCraft. That's a piece of shit.
I you know what? Honest to God, it may well be. I didn't play much StarCraft.
Oh, snap.
Really? Yeah. I didn't play much StarCraft or Brood War. I played Warcraft 2 and 3, and I kind of got in there, the kind of Blizzard RTSs, and I don't really play RTSs as a genre, but I think StarCraft 2 definitely deserves consideration as a best game ever. The game is... it's a real-time strategy game. In many ways, it is sort of like the definitive real-time strategy game.
How definitive is it?
It is super definitive. I think really it exemplifies one of the strengths of Blizzard as a developer, which is that they kind of define the core mechanics for the genres that they go after, right? Like Diablo, WoW, you know, the RTS in the form of Warcraft and then StarCraft. And they define them and then they iterate and perfect them and then they stick to them, which is they something that other developers don't necessarily do. Like I think that Blizzard has a habit of, and I think it's a good habit of, like, we make this game, we're going to iterate and make kind of small changes, but we're not making wholesale changes. And that's, you know, Diablo 3 is it's Diablo. You left click on stuff. That is the game.
Man, it is Diablo.
It is totally Diablo.
It is Diablo 2.
You know, other RTSs have kind of moved on into this more like squad-based. There are RTSs that don't even include resource collection at this point. And it's like, what are you even doing?
You know?
Totally. So, you know,
I need my Tiberium.
That's an interesting aspect of how Blizzard is as a developer. But I think, you know, StarCraft II in and of itself is just so great. Like, it has great music. The gameplay, obviously, if you don't like RTSs, you're not going to like it. And it is a fiddly RTS. Like, you have to mine those goddamn minerals, and you have to, you know, get the gas, and you have to know build orders, and all that stuff is real. And if you don't like it, you're not going to like the game. But I think they do a really great job of having a good single player experience. Also, I hadn't thought of this, but sort of like Mass Effect, a single player experience that is directly influenced by your multiplayer prowess and informed by it. But just a really good single player experience, right? Like, that game has a great plot that's, you know, gone across from StarCraft 1 Brood War into StarCraft 2, a plot that people are interested and invested in. And it's mechanically fun. Again, if you like that kind of stuff, they have great moments in the single player where you get to do stuff that, you know, would totally break the multiplayer if they included those units, but they'll have like big crazy mechs that we don't get to play with in multiplayer that'll totally shatter opposing armies, and you get these kind of summit type moments. That game has really good pacing in that respect. It does a great job of tutorializing missions so that in one way you can look at the entire single player campaign as a huge tutorial for multiplayer, and then you get to that multiplayer that multiplayer stage, and that's kind of a breaking point for many players. It's like, okay, do I really want to commit to this game? Because you have to know and play the game in a very different way to be successful in multiplayer. And I think that's a strength too, right? It's almost two different games. You can have this fun single player experience that you can play on normal difficulty, and much like, you know, Go or other, you know, board games of that ilk, chess to some extent, like the very best computer players are nowhere near even a basic level human player. So not like chess, right? Like Go doesn't have good computer AI at this point. Like, you know, average to good human players will always beat, you know, computer AI, and that's the case with StarCraft. Another aspect that's really great in terms of that multiplayer is the fact that it's the first chance for a legitimate, like, esport. You know, there's the MLG does Halo, and that's kind of big. And there's, you know, there are like competitive Counter-Strike teams. I think that the first one that has a real chance at actually like being shown on TV or breaking out into the wider culture is StarCraft. I think, you know, Dota to some extent has a chance there too. And, you know, that's mostly because of what the game looks like, right? Like, it's just hard for some people to watch Call of Duty or Halo. They literally get sick watching the game. So if you were to televise that, and it's hard to keep, if you don't know the layout of the map and you're watching an FPS game, you don't know what the fuck is going on. And, you know, just you're watching some viewpoint and then it gets shot at.
Oh, yeah,
and then
it's completely different in StarCraft. It's
totally. Yeah, in StarCraft, you have an observer. You're way up above the map. You can have, the games are long, right? Like, this is a big deal. 10 seconds of life until you get headshot from across the map and then back up is not a good viewing experience for somebody who doesn't know what's going on. But the development of a StarCraft game from the very basic, like, I have one command center and five SCVs to, you know, I've got a bunch of mechanical Thors and they're fucking flying broodlords, which is a unit that shoots other units. Like, there is, to, you know, this small level progression to a really, you know, late stage, late game, epic battle is totally interesting and makes it really worthwhile and probably, you know, the first thing, the first chance we have for the gaming hobby, at least the competitive side of it, to kind of break out into wider culture. So I think that's a point in its favor as well. It's a good game. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. The multiplayer aspect of it and it becoming an esport, the difference between an RTS and an FPS is totally the perspective. Like, you know, you watching a StarCraft game and you playing a StarCraft game are, you know, it's like one and the same. I mean, you're both, it's like you were looking down on a field, like a football game, and you have your units and they're battling against other units, and you're essentially making plays. Only, you know, if you're good, you're making like 50 plays per second, you know, in StarCraft.
It's 300. Oh yeah. Per second. I don't know what it would be. It's like 300 APM actions per minute is like top level pros.
Yeah. So that, yeah, that's like what, 5 moves a second.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I agree that that's a good, you know, part. I only played StarCraft. I haven't played StarCraft 2, but I mean, I get the gist because they're functionally the same game.
They're basically the same.
Yeah. And I played all through the single player. I didn't play much multiplayer. I'm not a very good multiplayer, especially real-time strategy gamer. I die like within, yeah, I die really quickly to pretty much anybody online. But I recognize that it's good. And I totally agree that it is, at least the franchise, I can't speak specifically about 2 because I haven't played it, but I just know that I'm sure it's as good as 1, if not better. So I would agree that it definitely should be a best game ever. Although I will sidetrack one way in that, much like I think I like the environment of Fallout more than Mass Effect, I like the world of Command and Conquer more than StarCraft. I have not read up much on Command and Conquer and how popular its multiplayer is compared to StarCraft. I know it must not be because I don't hear about it.
Yeah,
and they don't play them in games in leagues, so it must either be not as popular or not as balanced, not whatever. But I grew up playing Command and Conquer and loved that game and liked it more than StarCraft, I think, at least a little bit. Mm-hmm. It had the edge. So I think I'm more of a Command and Conquer fan. I don't know if it's just because the space alien motif doesn't resonate as much with me, and the Command and Conquer, much like Fallout, is more grounded. Like, I'm playing with soldiers, not Space Marines, and I'm playing with tanks, not like
tanks,
you know, or
well, there are definitely tanks.
Well, but they're space tanks. I'm not playing with space tanks. I'm playing with ground tanks that are actually modeled after like a tank that exists in real world. Like, there are no space tanks in the real world, so I can't really go to a museum and see StarCraft stuff. I can go to a museum and see Command and Conquer stuff, and it's not that it's better. I don't know. It just resonates more with me. And so I played the crap out of those games. And the campiness of Command & Conquer was another strong point. You know, StarCraft is Cerse, and Command & Conquer is not Cerse at all. It's completely non-Cerse, and I really like the non-Cerse-ness of it. Like, you know, Kane as the villain, and
there's FMV in Command & Conquer, right?
Oh, oh God. It's known for the FMV.
It is definitive FMV. I can't believe... Oh, man,
well, I thought the definitive FMV was Mark Hamill in Wing Commander.
No way.
No.
Well, Command and Conquer is so much more definitive.
Well, it's campier. It's known for its campiness. And
YouTube that shit.
I really love that. So I will agree with you. I still think StarCraft is amazing and should be a best game ever, but I give a slight edge to the Command and Conquer world.
For personal reasons.
For personal reasons, not necessarily for technical reasons.
Yeah, for personal reasons, actually, Warcraft 2 is my RTS.
Sweet. We've got all...
Back in the day.
All three edges.
The little catapults.
What you call me?
Were the best. I think this is going to come up just, you know, regularly. Mm-hmm. The concept of a game being just not for everyone, right?
What?
More so...
What the hell you say?
Than movies, food... I don't know, even books, other genres of entity,
consumption,
culture,
whatever,
other culture, et cetera. Culture.
You know, I could appreciate all kinds of good food and all kinds of good movies, et cetera. And quite a few different games, but because games require you to have, a certain amount of skill in a lot of different ways.
Yeah. You can't be bad at watching a movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So even if you don't like the horror genre,
so
like
blind people they suck at movies,
dude. That's not cool.
Sorry, blind people.
Someone else. Yeah, blind Call of Duty fighting game players are really getting fucked.
Episode. But deaf people are not good at movies too. And you know what? They didn't just hear me say that. So,
damn.
All right, we just got blacklisted. I'm sorry.
So StarCraft II as a sport, mm-hmm. as a spectator sport, that's what I was going for, is awesome. It's phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
But I do not enjoy playing it.
Have you ever played the single player?
I played through more than half of StarCraft II's campaign.
Oh, yeah?
And yeah, it's all right.
And you didn't like that?
I understand. God,
what's wrong with you?
I understand how people like it, but
those people suck. So,
it's right? Not for me. The pointing and clicking and dragging units and moving in places.
The thing about the multiplayer,
I don't know. I
the
really
part of the game where you do what you're supposed to do to progress.
Yeah, I prefer to control one unit, and I prefer to control that unit directly.
You should definitely start playing some of the more modern RTSs, because the genre has definitely gone in that direction.
I think it's
direction.
Gone towards, yeah. Like since Warcraft 3 and...
With the heroes.
Dota, yeah. And all the Dota clones. Mm-hmm. But those are inaccessible for whole other reasons. That we could get to later. And as far as your discussion about Blizzard defining genres they enter, wow, when they make Blizzard Dota, they certainly have the opportunity to redefine that genre or to play within its already defined limits.
Yeah,
that's going to be real interesting to see if they dramatically change it and improve it and they become the new standard, or whether they just, are a competitor. Because everybody's going to be in that field shortly, Valve and
yeah, that is definitely Legends, a crowded zone. One more thing I want to say about StarCraft II is that moments, particularly with multiplayer, and I am like total Bronze League scrub, like most people who play the game. You have moments when you're playing that game, and this is sort of one of the key values for me in games. I've described this, kind of off the air to you guys as well, is that what really makes me love a game is like my emotional investment moment to moment. And you have emotional highs in that game that you can almost not get anywhere else. Like, because it's not just that you won the game, but it's like you did it in a really clever way, or you knew more about the game than... It's like total Art of War stuff. It's like, I know my opponent is going to be doing this. I had a multiplayer game where this guy did this did a thing that you can do with Protoss called a cannon rush, right? It's a tactic where you just take one of your initial probes and you run it across the map. You find your enemy because there's fog of war. Back at home, you're building this this one structure called a forge, which lets you build cannons. And so you can get this forge up, and by the time you found your enemy, it's still very close to the beginning of the game. It's like a minute or 2 minutes into the game. You can place down a pylon, and you can place down these cannons and start shelling. Like, you can basically project force very early, way across at the other side of the map. And it's, it's a common tactic, and it's an interesting one and a powerful one. And I saw that this guy was doing it. I saw him, I got lucky with my scout to see his scout coming across the map. And I'm like, this motherfucker is totally going to cannon rush me. Like, I know what's happening. And so I instantly went and built another base at a totally different, it's like a 4-player map with only 2 of us on it. And I totally started a completely new base because I just knew it was going to happen. And I felt so fucking smart when I did that. And I totally ended up winning the game because I played like, oh shit, I don't know what to do. And I don't know how to handle your cannon rush. And I knew he was sitting on the other end going like, I'm fucking winning this. My cannon rush strategy is so awesome. This is rad. I'm
this
so good.
Such a noob.
Yeah, what a fool. I'm crushing him. And then I had this whole other base and I built like a flock of Colossus and Void Ray, and I went across the map and I just obliterated him, and it was like the greatest feeling ever.
Good
like,
show, old chap.
It can't. And of course, I lose way more games than I win, and that was just like, you just have those kind of moments, and that's the kind of moment you can only have in that kind of a game, a game where it is a chess match, So yes, StarCraft II.
Game. It's interesting that you just compared it to a chess match, because I think it's very different from chess in that there is no downtime. From the clock starting, you have to be moving. I mean, the fact that they even have an actions per minute unit of measurement in that game obviously says this is not a in defense of boring game. This is not a Fez, let's stop and look at the pretty colors and enjoy myself. This is, and I think maybe why I'm so for that guy's argument is because I often don't like games that force me to not enjoy myself in a meditative, pleasant way. Not, mm-hmm. It doesn't even have to be meditative. It just says, I want to be able to get in a game and like, yeah. No one breathes in a StarCraft game.
No, you don't.
If you breathe, you die. And yeah. And that kind of those kinds of stakes are not fun because I don't play games at that level.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm immediately turned off by a game like that. Much right. Like most deathmatch games, mm-hmm. Like a Quake or whatever, I suck and I don't enjoy because those games also penalize you for enjoying being in the game. They only reward you for being ruthless.
Yes.
And of course, I'm glad that games are like that, but I'm probably never going to like or excel at those games because those just make me anxious and I can't do it. But lots of people freaking love it, and that's all they love.
Right, that feeling...
Excuse me.
That feeling that you describe that, you know, as unattainable anywhere else, you know, than in this competitive StarCraft match. I think the feeling is virtually identical in potentially in any competitive multiplayer setting. And I've never felt that as much as in Guild Wars, 4-on-4 arena, random teams, mostly random. I got that adrenaline rush so hard. I used to have to, I would get shivers and I'd have to go put on a hooded sweatshirt even though it wasn't cold.
Yeah.
You know?
Just don't walk outside and have Skittles in your hand.
Right, yes.
Ooh, topical.
And
does
yeah.
Guild Wars include stand your ground rules?
but I'm sure that it's a bit different when the competition is on that higher, more cerebral level. Guild Wars falls somewhere in the middle. Of Call of Duty and StarCraft in terms of Call of Duty being the fastest and the
twitchiest.
The twitchiest, right? Yeah. Theoretically, the least cerebral, although it's not devoid of strategy.
Mm-hmm.
But Guild Wars is somewhere in the middle with some strategy, but a little bit slower pace, but still, you know, you still have time to run around.
The cooperative aspect is a difference, too, and that's something that's cool. And I wish actually there was more competitive StarCraft. All the tournaments are basically 1v1. And they have stuff called team leagues where instead of, you know, one player against another player, which is how most of the tournaments work, it'll be like a team against a team. So they get like the whole pro team against another one. And there's some interesting strategy that comes in there because, like, you know, who do the managers, like, who do I think they're going to put up first and who should I put up against that person? And there's a little bit of it's kind of interesting how that interplays. But what I was saying is I wish they would do more, you know, occasionally in those team leagues, they'll do, you know, 2v2 or 4v4. And those are always really fun, but for some reason, it's not as popular, but I always think that those are really cool matches. And I like the cooperative competitive aspect.
I think the difference with cooperative StarCraft is it's less role-based naturally.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everybody's on this relatively equal footing, no matter which race you are, and responsible for doing all the same things. I guess there's some extent, although not as advanced a StarCraft watcher as you, but I'm sure there's some cases where people kind of assign roles between their team, but it's not as much so as for example, Guild Wars, where you can have a healer.
Way less than in an MMO, like way less. The only thing you can do, the only strategy that I've ever seen that kind of does that is there's something called a feeder strategy, where if you're playing 2v2, you can have one person focus exclusively on economy and expanding really quickly and just getting a shit ton of money and then giving those resources to the other player who's focusing only. That's basically the only time you can do something like that. And like, yeah, that's the one
right
kind of role-oriented strategy.
But StarCraft is so like amazing in this way that it requires this research and metagame knowledge and this you know, mid-tier strategy for your specific game and planning, you know, that type of strategy, and then also this twitchy micro and the ability to just defeat someone with fewer units in a tiny little battle that should have gone the other way just because you had better micro there.
Right.
So it demands the most out of a player of any game I can think of. So it's really, really impressive for that, but it also makes it kind of the least accessible too.
For competitive play, absolutely, yeah.
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 So, yeah, as a spectator sport, wow. Definitely a best game ever.
Sweet.
Well, and I'll just add, just before we wrap up here, that, you know, even in non-gaming sports like basketball and baseball and football and stuff, even though those are team-based sports, the stories that get told are often individual stories, you know? I mean, yes, there are stories about, you know, the 68 Cubs or whatever, but it's the players, you know, like the Michael Jordan of basketball or the Joe Montana of football or the, you know, Babe Ruth of baseball. You know, people are interested, the human interest in the one individual versus individual, which is why I think the 1v1 is so popular. Even if it were 4v4, it's going to come down to the star player on that team that the stories are going to be centered on, because that's the story that people that go to, or at least that get made. So, all right. Well, I think that's good for episode 2 of the Escort Mission here. I'm not even sure I said my name when we started this off. I totally forget to say, hi, this is Mike. I've been hosting again because I won the roll.
Jerk.
Because apparently
you're
going to have to roll like 10 ones in a row.
Apparently I hacked random.org. But yes, I'm Mike. I'm also here with Charles and with Josh. We are the Escort Mission. And I believe that wraps us up. Thanks for being here, guys, and talking.
Bye, everyone.
Late.
Lates.